the only way out of the world's most dangerous standoff. Both the Clinton and second Bush administrations had made considerable diplomatic inroads with the Hermit Kingdom. In 1994, the United States actually succeeded in brokering a denuclearization agreement in which Pyongyang agreed to freeze and dismantle its entire program. North Korea cheated, purchasing equipment for highly enriched uranium development. But some veterans of North Korea diplomacy maintain that the United States sealed the doom of the agreement by failing to live up to its own commitments. Pledges to build light water reactors and provide fuel to Pyongyang were both sabotaged amidst political fights between the Clinton administration and a Republican Congress. Bush sealed the demise of the agreement when he took office, walking away altogether. Over the course of his first term, the administration adopted a more bellicose stance, listing the North Korean regime as one it might have to use nuclear weapons against and returning to saber-rattling condemnations. In George W. Bush's second term, however, Condoleezza Rice tried anew. She sent a career diplomat named Christopher Hill, who had been part of the negotiating team that brokered peace in the Balkans under Richard Holbrooke, to lead six-party talks on denuclearizing North Korea. "This administration has fought two wars," Rice told Hill wearily, "and now we are looking for a few diplomats." Hill and a team of tireless Foreign Service officers, including Yuri Kim, who a decade later became embroiled in Trump's Mahogany Row massacre, threw themselves into the challenge for years. They endured weeks away from their families, long hours on flights across the world, and 12 to 13-hour negotiation marathons in Beijing. The North Koreans were among the thorniest opponents in the world. Even in the Balkans, there had been moments of personal icebreaking, discussions of children and grandchildren, sports and hobbies. The North Koreans had a robot-like reputation, according to Hill. After years of tense late nights together, he felt he barely knew them. Throughout the ups and downs, Hill tried to carry forward the lessons of diplomats past, including his boss in the Balkans. When the Chinese didn't show for a promised meeting, and proceeding without them meant going rogue and defying his marching orders, his first thought was, would Holbrooke have canceled the meeting? And he persevered. Later, at a low point in the negotiations, Holbrooke himself showed up to rally Hill's team. "They were a part of history," he told them, as he later told me in Afghanistan. "They should enjoy the moment. You may never have another like it." It was through those years of high-wire diplomacy that Chris Hill found himself, in the fall of 2007, standing in a white gown and hood, surveying an aging plutonium plant about 2 hours north of Pyongyang. Sections of the facility's thick pipes were being sawed to pieces. American and international disablers were on hand to supervise. 7 months later, North Korea would blow up the plant's cooling tower. It was historic, the first time North Korea had deactivated a reactor since 2001. In the end, it wasn't enough. Pyongyang submitted a visibly incomplete accounting of its nuclear activities, then grew cold at demands for more. But talks had left behind a considerable legacy to build upon. Rifts had been closed in a rocky relationship with South Korea, and cooperation had been established to a degree once thought impossible with China, the single most important player in any resolution of the North Korean crisis to this day. And so it was a surprise for many of the career diplomats involved when the Obama administration repeated the same mistake the Bush administration made in its first term and walked away from those years of diplomatic inroads entirely. Frankly, I think what really happened was the Obama administration looked at the heat everyone got for trying to do something with North Korea, whether it was the Clinton administration or the second Bush term, Hill reflected. The Obama administration just decided, we have other priorities, and this thing will wither on the vine. They never got serious. I asked Hillary Clinton whether she regretted that turn away from North Korea. "No, we," she stammered. "Chris Hill was continuing his negotiations when we were there." When I told her Hill felt the effort was sidelined, she said, "I can't speak to that. I don't know that. I'm not going to agree or disagree with him." I'd never heard her sound so tired. Maybe he didn't feel there was support from the White House or the Pentagon, she went on, but we certainly tried to get things going at the State Department as best we could. Hill and the other diplomats who presided over the effort remain in agreement about one thing. Diplomacy is still the only way forward. If we get out of the North Korean situation, it's probably going to be because of diplomacy, Condoleezza Rice said. In Hill's view, that might not mean more talks with North Korea, at least not right away, but it had to mean intensive talks with China. If you can't get serious about working directly with the North Koreans, which I totally understand, he pled as Donald Trump ramped up his rhetoric at the UN, then at least get serious with China. That's where I think we need to have a lot more serious diplomacy. And by that I mean we can't just be sending them messages in the night via Twitter accounts. We need to really sit down and have a no-kidding discussion about our mutual interests. The Chinese agreed. By 2017, they were making public calls for six-party talks. It was a way to appear responsible without committing to the cutting of ties with North Korea it had long resisted. Just the kind of stance on which a team of skilled American diplomats might move the needle. Brian Hook, the policy planning director, said that behind closed doors, Tillerson had, through sheer diplomatic persistence, pressed China into a tougher stance on North Korea. It began when he sat down with Chinese officials during his visit to Beijing and said, "You can do this the easy way or the hard way, but you guys have to play a much greater role in denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula," he told me. Whether those efforts could have prevailed would remain a question mark. Trump forced Tillerson out before they could bear fruit. Instead, Trump astonished allies when, in a meeting with a South Korean delegation, he agreed on the spot to personally meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. This was announced, almost casually, by the South Koreans after the meeting. Rex Tillerson, who had just hours earlier said the United States was still a long way from negotiations, told the press that the president hadn't spoken to him beforehand, surprising no one. But as far as anyone could tell, Trump hadn't told any other officials either. White House and State Department personnel scrambled to adjust course. The agreement was a curveball. Some hoped it would thaw relations, but many in the foreign policy establishment feared the move, undertaken out of the blue and absent broader diplomatic context, would be taken by North Korea as recognition of its status as a nuclear power. And officials worried that Trump, mercurial to begin with, would have little by way of a diplomatic team behind him to guide any talks. It was hard to see the United States' capacity for diplomacy in the region as anything but downsized. At the State Department, the sizable North Korea unit led by Yuri Kim a decade earlier no longer existed. A year into Trump's tenure, there wasn't even a permanent assistant secretary for East Asia. The rest of the world has not stood by as America relinquishes its leadership in diplomacy and development. The balance of global diplomatic power is shifting. During Tillerson's first trip to China as Secretary of State, he and President Xi Jinping sat in matching taupe leather armchairs in front of a mural of Chinese pastoral beauty, cranes soaring over pristine valleys and forests. They wore matching red ties and dark jackets, and, in a move that left close followers of U.S.-Chinese relations agape, they used matching language. President Xi urged the United States to expand cooperative areas and achieve win-win results. Tillerson agreed. The U.S. side is ready to develop relations with China based on the principle of no conflict, no confrontation, mutual respect, and win-win cooperation. A lay observer might have blinked and missed it, but Asia experts at the State Department and beyond saw something unusual immediately. Tillerson had all but copy-pasted earlier statements by Xi, who just a few months before had expressed hope that President Trump would uphold the principles of non-conflict, non-confrontation, mutual respect, and win-win cooperation. That was the most recent of many examples of Xi and other communist officials using that coded sequence of terms to describe a new balance of powers, with China as an equal to the United States and the U.S. deferring to Chinese prerogatives on contentious issues from Taiwan to territorial disputes in the South China Sea. State-run media instantly picked up on the dog whistle. Tillerson has implicitly endorsed the new model of major power relations, crowed the communist-affiliated Global Times, saying Tillerson's language had given U.S. allies in the Asia-Pacific region an impression that China and the U.S. are equal, as Barack Obama refused to do. Several officials at the State Department told me the Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, home to regional experts attuned to the significance of such language, had not been consulted on the statement. Instead, it had been drafted by the White House, according to several sources there, by the office of Jared Kushner. Brian Hook, the director of policy planning, did not dispute this account of events, but said that an acting official from the Asia Bureau was on the trip. Was the acting official involved in drafting the statements, I asked? I don't recall, Hook said. You've been on these trips. You know, they're a blur. Did Tillerson intend to mirror their language, I asked? He is not intending to mirror their language. But is he aware that's what he did? He signs off on every statement he delivers. He believes in win-win. He believes that China and the U.S. can work together. Later, Hook added that Tillerson assigns different meanings than the Chinese do to stock formulations. For example, the secretary believes in win-win, but that doesn't mean two wins for China. Hook described Tillerson's approach to China as results-based, with a willingness to counter any Chinese actions that harm our interests. But in the eyes of some career diplomats, those goals were being undermined by the steadfast refusal to draw on expertise within the system. An official in the Asia Bureau said watching that trip unfold, with no contact between Tillerson and the experts back home that would typically be consulted on such statements, was like being locked outside, watching an enthusiastic dog tear up your upholstery. As America's diplomats face budget cuts, China's coffers are more flush with each passing year. Beijing has poured money into development projects, including a $1.4 trillion slate of infrastructure initiatives around the world that would dwarf the Marshall Plan adjusted for inflation. Its spending on foreign assistance is still a fraction of the United States, but the trend line is striking, with funding growing by an average of more than 20% annually since 2005. The rising superpower is making sure the world knows it. In one recent year, the U.S. State Department spent $666 million on public diplomacy, aimed at winning hearts and minds abroad. While it's difficult to know exactly what China spends on equivalent programs, one analysis put the value of its external propaganda programs at about $10 billion a year. In international organizations, Beijing looms large behind a retreating Washington, D.C. As the U.S. proposes cuts to its U.N. spending, China has become the second-largest funder of U.N. peacekeeping missions. It now has more peacekeepers in conflicts around the world than the four other permanent Security Council members combined. The move is pragmatic. Beijing gets more influence and plum appointments in the United Nations governing bodies. Around the world, the same transformation is playing out. The caricature of China's foreign policy offered by Western powers, ruthless economic expansion, unmoored from either ethical compunction or willingness to engage diplomatically, was accurate for years. Now, in Afghanistan, China is exploring a mediating role in that country's complex relationship with neighboring Pakistan. In Sudan, China for decades maintained a policy of non-interference, buying oil from the notorious National Islamic Front National Congress Party in Khartoum as that regime massacred civilians in Darfur and South Sudan. Sudan's brutalized population pleaded in vain for China to use its unique leverage to demand peace. Now, China's Africa envoy shuttles around the region, offering to facilitate mediations and trying to craft a settlement to the violence that still engulfs South Sudan. Beijing called the hands-on approach a new chapter in its foreign policy. The impact is starker in Asia. As the Trump administration abandoned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, a regional trade agreement that the Obama administration had led and nurtured since 2009, China swiftly stepped in with its own massive trade pact. And in countries around the region, the difference is being felt on the ground. The Trump administration proposed cutting assistance to Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan entirely. These were small programs, but they were the only visible manifestation of American influence in countries strategically located adjacent to both the war in Afghanistan and the United States' showdown with Russia. They're also home to brand new train lines delivered under China's sweeping One Belt, One Road initiative. It's a completely self-inflicted wound, John Kerry said of China's encroachment on the kind of diplomacy and development the United States once dominated. It worries me a lot more than many of the other issues consuming the public debate most days, in terms of a big, powerful, ambitious country setting the agenda and executing on it. They're eating our lunch today, and this president has invited it because he thinks our retreat is some kind of accomplishment. China is no global hero. It would be an oversimplification to argue that these first forays into diplomatic leadership can fully counter the United States' deeply rooted legacy of engagement. And Beijing brings to the table a very different kind of leadership. Still ruthless, still burdened by its refusal to confront its own human rights abuses. But the trajectory is meaningful. Already, for the child born in Kazakhstan today, one world power's leadership will be evident, and the others will not. Already, from Sudan to Pakistan, I have spoken to young people who grew up with more visible and aggressively branded Chinese infrastructure. If China can mature as a diplomatic power as rapidly as it has as a force for economic development, America will have ceded one of the most important ways in which great powers shape the world. Epilogue. The Tool of First Resort. Vienna, 2015. There are two types of military dispute, the one settled by negotiation and the other by force. Since the first is characteristic of human beings and the second of beasts, we must have recourse to the second only if we cannot exploit the first. Cicero, On Duties. The steady dissolution of the State Department under the Trump administration may appear to be a logical outcome of years of imbalanced foreign policy, but it is not an inevitable one. The trend of sideline diplomats and ascendant soldiers and spies since September 11, 2001 has not been linear. Diplomats who served in the Bush administration point to the return of North Korea diplomacy through Christopher Hill's efforts and initiatives like PEPFAR, the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, which channeled billions into life-saving medical treatment in developing countries. And, taken together, the Iran deal and the Paris Climate Accord represented a rearguard action for diplomacy. They were the more striking for the contrast they represented after a first term of the Obama administration that was comparatively dismissive of diplomats and barren of large-scale diplomatic endeavor. Ben Rhodes, Obama's deputy national security advisor, attributed the late breakthroughs partly to the slow-burn nature of diplomacy and partly to course correction. The centerpieces of our second-term foreign policy were much more diplomatic in nature than in our first term, and you also had an effort to... He paused, seeming to reflect on the failures of the Holbrooke era. The kind of superstar general dynamic, the Petraeus-McChrystal dynamic, was not present in the second term. Not that generals weren't stars, it's just that they weren't these giant public figures who sucked up oxygen in certain parts of the world. I think there was a slow, admittedly, but steady reprioritization of diplomacy. The results were controversial. Proof points of diplomacy's power for some, and of its folly for others. But even as Trump withdrew the United States from Paris, and as fierce debate over the Iran deal and its virtues and vices continued, it could not be denied that these were serious foreign policy initiatives born of hard-fought, old-school diplomacy. Little surprise that the most controversial of those initiatives, the Iran deal, would begin and end with shouting. It was night when one of those rounds of shouting began, echoing off gilt and white-paneled walls and rococo chairs and an ornate marble fireplace with a mantle held up by cherubs. Half of the shouts were from Iran's foreign minister, backtracking on how many years his country would assent to constraints on its nuclear program. Half were from the American Secretaries of State and Energy, telling the Iranians to, in not so many words, go to hell. "I've had it with this," John Kerry was shouting. "You cannot do what you're threatening to do." If Iran wanted to renegotiate basic terms, the United States was more than happy to walk away. It was July 2015, and Iranian, American, British, French, Chinese, Russian, German, and European Union negotiators had converged on Vienna for a final tortured stretch of diplomacy. The Hyperlux Palais Coburg, where Johann Strauss had once conducted in the glittering ballroom, and where the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha dynasty had schemed and inbred and reclined in scented baths until its last princess expired in the 1990s, was selected as the venue for the talks partly because its 34 rooms allowed for few guests to overhear conversations like this. Still, those who could afford to stay at the Palais Coburg, spies and diplomats, bankers and barons, had keen ears. And by then, 600 reporters had descended on hushed Vienna for just such gossip. The Americans, in the next dining room over, were nervous. Kerry kind of lost it, lost his temper, John Finer, Kerry's chief of staff and, later, the director of policy planning at State, remembered. A lot of us were gathering in the dining area outside where this meeting was, and people were able to hear the shouts coming through the walls. Kerry's longtime body man, Jason Meininger, finally opened the doors and interrupted. He delicately informed the Americans and the Iranians that random guests were hearing the intimate details of the most sensitive diplomacy in the world. There turned out to be some truth to this. Over breakfast the next morning, Germany's foreign minister, and later president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, dryly congratulated Kerry for what he assumed were productive talks, seeing as the whole hotel heard them. Ultimately, the most powerful diplomats in the world would spend 18 days trapped in splendor. Night after night, negotiations stretched into the small hours of the morning. The red-eyed U.S. team went through 10 pounds of strawberry-flavored Twizzlers, 20 pounds of string cheese, 30 pounds of mixed nuts and dried fruit, and hundreds of Rice Krispies treats and espresso pods. The night after the shouting match, the showdown had a reprise in a larger meeting of the ministers of the P5 plus 1, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, plus Germany. As Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif tried to insist on a more lenient time frame, the EU's Federica Mogherini said she'd sooner go home than consider it. "Never threaten an Iranian," Zarif bellowed. "Or a Russian," added Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov slyly, cutting the tension. But in fact, Russia had fallen in line with the Americans and Europeans. Again and again, Lavrov helped the U.S. break logjams, a remarkable fact as the Ukraine crisis worsened and U.S.-Russian relations went into a deep freeze. It was one of the many unusual characteristics of an unusual diplomatic effort, a unified front. Even China signed up to play an important role helping to modify one of Iran's reactors. The process was also an anachronistic showcase of diplomatic grit. For Bill Burns, it was the last mission of a decades-long career in the Foreign Service that had taken him from ambassadorships in Russia and Jordan to, at the time of the Iran negotiations, the second-in-command job at the State Department. Burns was what you'd picture when you envision a career diplomat. He was lanky with a salt-and-pepper mustache and a creaky, soft voice that seemed impossibly patient and even-tempered. He was, a Washington Post headline declared upon his retirement, a diplomat's diplomat. When John Kerry told me about the challenges of encouraging young diplomats, he referred to the importance of finding the next generation of talented foreign service, the next Bill Burns, so to speak. Burns was a living testament to the irreplaceable role foreign service officers could still play. He had been involved in American diplomacy with Iran dating back 30 years. To when he joined the National Security Council staff at the White House immediately after the Iran-Contra affair. "As a relatively young diplomat," he said, "the perils of Iran diplomacy were driven home to me because of how badly that all ended." But Iran had a gravitational pull for him. Years later, he had run the Middle East Bureau in Colin Powell's State Department and grown distressed at the shrinking space for diplomacy and the growing emphasis on policy made out of the Pentagon. I saw firsthand the inversion of diplomacy and the use of force that was so characteristic of the run-up to the Iraq War, he continued. That inversion, he felt, was one reason why earlier opportunities to approach Iran, when its nuclear program was still in its infancy, were shunned. It wasn't until the very last year of the Bush administration, when Burns was serving as the Undersecretary for Political Affairs under Condoleezza Rice, that the administration began to warm to the idea of a diplomatic approach. It was that summer that Burns sat, for the first time, directly opposite the Iranians, in a meeting of world powers in Geneva. That really opened up a new phase, in a sense, Burns reflected, which, you know, Obama drove through much more ambitiously. In the summer of 2009, the United States discovered a secret uranium enrichment facility, not far from the holy city of Qom, and responded with a wave of new sanctions squeezing every aspect of Iran's economy. This entailed careful diplomacy. State Department and Treasury officials appealed to country after country to cut ties, creating a unified front of economic warfare. The impact was devastating. Their oil exports dropped by 50%, Burns recalled. The value of their currency dropped by 50%. That pressure set the stage for talks. In March 2013, at a military officer's beach house in Oman, which had demonstrated its pull with Tehran by brokering the release of several imprisoned American hikers, Burns and four colleagues held their first secret talks with the Iranians. Over the course of 3 days, he and the head of the Iranian delegation walked the grounds and spent long hours in a light-filled conference room with a wide view of the Arabian Sea. "I think we left with the sense that there might be an opening here," Burns said. The Iranians were still on a tight leash from Tehran, but they were working-level diplomats, not the national security hardliners who had shown up for international talks before. That distinction would be important on both sides. Talks gathered steam when Iran surprised the world by electing as president Hassan Rouhani, a perceived moderate who ran on a platform of thawing the freeze on Iran's economy. He installed Javad Zarif, a Western-educated Charlie Rose regular, as foreign minister. Over the following year, Burns would lead 9 or 10 secret negotiations in capitals around the world. In one case, "We did a patch of negotiations in Muscat, then flew to Beijing, then flew back to Oman, then back to Beijing," remembered John Finer, who was present for many of the later talks. As the months dragged on, the negotiators began to develop a personal rapport. When one of the American diplomats, Wendy Sherman, and her counterpart, Majid Takht Ravanchi, both became grandparents in the fall of 2013, they shared pictures. Kerry and Zarif held such long meetings that New York Magazine later photoshopped a cloud of hearts between the two men and placed them atop a listicle entitled, "The Most Romantic Moments of the Iran Deal Negotiations." By the end of 2013, an interim agreement had been signed. In April 2015, that progressed to a framework agreement, and over the following 3 months, the fight to translate the commitments developed over the previous years into a final deal played out in Vienna. As the secret talks advanced, some aspects of the American position softened. Obama made a very critical policy decision, which was the U.S. might consider a very, very limited enrichment program if Iran agreed to very strict monitoring and verification, recalled Sherman. Iran having a nuclear program would happen with or without our blessings, the thinking went. The sanctions, Sherman, Burns, and the rest of the Americans became convinced, could only slow that down. Negotiations offered the only hope of ensuring oversight of Iran's activities. The concession of allowing a civil nuclear program, a source of rebuke from opponents of the deal to this day, was an inflection point, one of the most significant factors in making the cascade of agreements that followed possible. Sherman compared the deal to a Rubik's Cube, with each twist messing up another facet of the negotiations. Later, a Department of Energy official gave Rubik's Cubes to 40 of the American negotiators, including Finer and Sherman, as a gag gift, the word gag loosely applied. The talks literally broke several members of the team. Wendy Sherman broke her nose slamming into a door while rushing to brief Kerry on a secure line, and ruptured her pinky finger, tumbling down a staircase en route to one of the team's many Senate briefings defending the negotiations against political attacks. She put her finger on ice and carried on with the briefing anyway. "I was quite focused. It was a really good briefing," she said. After answering the last question, she burst into tears. In one heated negotiation in Geneva in 2015, John Kerry slammed his hand on the table so hard a pen went flying and hit one of the Iranian negotiators. Still rattled the day after, he'd gone for a bike ride in the French Alps to clear his head, which is a thing you do if you're John Kerry and you're too far from the coast to windsurf. Distracted by a passing motorcycle, he slammed into a barrier and went flying, shattering his femur. From Muscat to New York and Geneva to Vienna, they persevered and entreated allies to do the same. In July 2015, after one last push that stretched until 3 a.m., the ministers lined up at the United Nations in Vienna, looking tired in front of a row of their country's flags as flashbulbs went off. Together, they announced a deal that would constrain Iran's nuclear ambitions for at least a decade. The rogue nation that had flouted sustained diplomacy with the outside world for more than 30 years had consented to rigorous, intrusive checks and verifications. John Kerry took the opportunity to defend the deal against what he knew would be years of outrage from those who opposed the very idea of talks and those who would argue that the United States got snookered. "I will just share with you, very personally, years ago when I left college, I went to war," he told the assembled press, referring to his time in Vietnam. "And I learned in war the price that is paid when diplomacy fails. And I made a decision that if I ever was lucky enough to be in a position to make a difference, I would try to do so." His voice, hoarse and weary, cracked with emotion. "I know that war is the failure of diplomacy, and the failure of leaders to make alternative decisions." The deal was a lightning rod for criticism. Getting to the finish line required what some considered to be unacceptable compromises. Back in 2009, Obama had ordered the CIA and the State Department to stand down from supporting anti-government protesters in Iran's Green Revolution, fearing regime change would explode the secret diplomatic entrees. Some critics argued that the Obama administration's obsessive pursuit of the deal had also contributed to its inaction in Syria, after Iran threatened to pull out of talks if the United States interfered with the Tehran-allied Syrian regime. And the deal itself, affording Iran the right to a low level of nuclear enrichment insufficient for weapons production, and featuring some restraints that would expire after a decade, was no clean victory. Others argued it was a deal with the devil. From stoning rape victims to imprisoning journalists, including Americans, Iran was hardly a reformed actor. When the Trump administration set about lobbying against the deal and failed to gain traction on claims that Iran had cheated, many of its arguments were instead premised on this. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley talked at length about Iran's history since 1979 as a rogue nation and sponsor of terrorism, urging the world to view Iran as a jigsaw puzzle, incorporating more pieces than the nuclear issue. The deal's negotiators were the first to admit its imperfections. But this was, they argued, what a diplomatic victory looked like. The deal was narrowly focused on the singular, pressing challenge of Iran's nuclear ambitions. Nowhere did it seek to address the country's human rights record, or its support for anti-U.S. elements in Syria, or its non-nuclear weapons tests. It was hard to envision, the deal's proponents said, how taking nuclear talks off the table would do anything but diminish the United States' ability to address any of those other issues. "We recognized that there were a lot of other elements of Iranian behavior that would threaten our interests and the interests of our friends," Bill Burns told me. "But being able to resolve the nuclear issue without a shot being fired in a way that serves our interests is a pretty significant step." There were also few alternatives. Without the agreement, Kerry argued, you were going to have near-term military action, period. Breakout time was down to a couple months. So, either on our watch or early in Trump's presidency, without the deal, you were going to have a confrontation. The Obama administration had reviewed the military options, and they looked bleak. They could temporarily debilitate specific sites, but there was no way to keep the Iranians from rebuilding. You were going to be in the situation of doing it once, then making diplomacy totally impossible because once you've bombed them, Finer recalled of the administration's view of tactical options, they're pretty unlikely to sit at the table and negotiate with you. They're going to try to race to a bomb covertly, away from monitoring, and then you're going to be in a position where you have to find it and bomb it again, maybe in 2 years down the road, and so you're in perpetuity in this cycle. There is this notion out there that there is a better deal or a perfect deal to be had, and life's not like that, Burns added. You can make an argument that, had we seriously engaged with the Iranians a decade earlier, when they were spinning 64 centrifuges and a very primitive effort of an enrichment program, maybe we could have produced sharper limits on their nuclear program. The reality was, at the beginning of 2013, when we began the secret talks in earnest, they were spinning almost 19,000 centrifuges, and there was no way in which you could bomb or wish that away. The challenge in diplomacy was always going to produce something short of a perfect solution. This was how complex negotiated settlements looked. 20 years earlier, the agreement Richard Holbrooke brokered in Dayton had compromised deeply, too, attaching rights of political representation to ethnic groups and creating a bloated, unwieldy government in an effort to satisfy everyone. Several of the diplomats behind the Iran deal, including Sherman and Finer, banded together to take the fight to Congress and the media. They argued that withdrawal would diminish the United States' influence and that China and Russia would seize on the opportunity to drive a wedge between the U.S. and its European allies, which were significantly invested in the deal. Most of all, the diplomats feared how the destruction of the world's most significant non-proliferation deal with a hostile state might echo across the world in another great crisis. If we ditch this deal, Finer said, what are the North Koreans going to think? What incentive do the North Koreans have to even contemplate negotiating anything? For all its flaws, it was a deal, and one that offered lessons on the factors that can still converge to make diplomacy work in the present day. The Iran negotiators prevailed through their trials partly because the president offered full-bodied support, with little micromanagement. Before each round of negotiations, Obama ran through his red lines with Kerry and Sherman, then reminded them they were empowered to walk away if they saw fit. By the end of the years-long journey to Vienna, dozens of State Department officials had been involved in the deal. I spoke to many of them. Uniformly, they recalled feeling empowered by the White House and how integral that was to their work. If there was to be a roadmap for the future of American diplomacy, many career diplomats told me, it was this. Embracing the compromise and imperfection of the deals, realizing that they could avert war and save lives. Investing in working-level diplomats and giving them a long enough leash to do their jobs. And installing leadership with a visionary belief in large-scale diplomatic initiatives like the ones the Trump administration seemed bent on dismantling. Those proposals looked, in their way, not unlike the reforms that had reshaped state in the years after World War II. On Iran, Cuba, and Paris, I think it's really, frankly, just three policies where whichever administration came in after us was handed a series of opportunities, big ones, and frankly had some diplomatic openings that past secretaries would have loved to have teed up to explore, John Kerry said. The worst-case scenario of the Iran deal, he continued to believe as the Trump administration began its pushback, was that Iran would resist compliance, isolating the Iranians, not the Americans. The consequences of the United States unilaterally imploding the deal were, he argued, far worse. Trump's done it backwards, with bluster. He's isolated us. If the deal goes belly up, the world will blame us, not Iran. Kerry went for a jab. If that's the art of the deal, you can see why this guy filed for bankruptcy 7 times. It was a soundbite from another era, when you could shame someone into seeing the error of their ways, when a crystal-clear case, a sound argument, could make a difference. But in American politics, that time had passed. Ultimately, more than 80 arms control specialists signed a letter defending the Iran deal as a net plus for international nuclear non-proliferation efforts and warning that unilateral action by the United States, especially on the basis of unsupported contentions of Iranian cheating, would isolate the United States. But that message didn't penetrate the Trump administration, which continued to publicly excoriate Iran. The time of specialists playing a formative role in foreign policy, some career officials feared, may have passed too. Just days after assuming power, the new administration had, of course, fired its top in-house expert on non-proliferation. So it was that on a cold Sunday in January 2017, Tom Countryman found himself clearing out his office at the State Department. It was the end of 35 years of service, but he was unsentimental. "There was so much to do," he said with a shrug. "I'm not sure I pondered it." On most Sundays, the department was eerily empty, but on this one, Countryman wasn't alone. Undersecretary Patrick Kennedy, after 44 years in the Foreign Service, was cleaning out his desk as well. The two graying diplomats took a break from their boxes of paperwork and family photos to reminisce. Kennedy had been in the thick of the Iraq War as chief of staff for the Coalition Provisional Authority. Countryman had been in Egypt as that country joined the Gulf War. It was an improbably quiet end to a pair of high-stakes careers, memories, and empty desks as the State Department stood still. A few days had passed since Countryman was fired while on a mission in Jordan, and he had done his best to wrap up what he could. There hadn't been time to talk to most of his 260 employees in the Bureau of International Security and Nonproliferation. In any case, there was little to say that could provide clarity about what was to come. The following Tuesday, he had one last chance to say goodbye. More than 100 career officers crammed into a reception area on the first floor with a stained ceiling and industrial gray carpeting. The crowd clutched white styrofoam cups as Countryman took to a podium. Since his firing less than a week before, Tom Countryman had become something of a minor celebrity, a symbol of an embattled profession. One colleague compared the end of his career to Obi-Wan Kenobi getting cut down by Darth Vader in Star Wars, which Countryman found touching. Another, he added archly, compared it to the scene where Princess Leia strangles Jabba the Hutt, and I found that confusing. He had spent days thinking through a message, a lesson, something of worth to leave behind. Countryman was not, he told the crowd of beleaguered diplomats, disgruntled. He was, in fact, probably the most gruntled person in the room. He told them about a career that had given him a first-hand view of world and diplomatic history. He spoke of ambassadors legendary, and of the bright young officers who, he was convinced, still rose from the ranks of the Foreign Service. But he also sounded a warning. "A foreign policy without professionals is," he said, "by definition, an amateur foreign policy." "Stay," he urged the assembled officers, even as he acknowledged that theirs was a profession out of step with the times. "Our work is little understood by our fellow Americans, a fact that is sometimes exploited for political purpose. Only they," he said, "could serve as a bulwark against an increasingly transactional and militarized approach to the world. Our consular officers are the first of many lines of defense against those who would come to the U.S. with evil purpose. We want the families of America's heroes, our servicemen, to know that their loved ones are not put into danger simply because of a failure to pursue non-military solutions. If our interaction with other countries is only a business transaction, rather than a partnership with allies and friends, we will lose that game too. China practically invented transactional diplomacy, and if we choose to play their game, Beijing will run the table." These were the fears of the surviving diplomats who remembered a different time, when talking and listening counted for something, and the State Department was an indispensable instrument of American power. "We have unilaterally disarmed, basically," Wendy Sherman reflected. "If you don't have diplomacy as a tool, you have unilaterally undermined your own power. Why would we do that?" She sighed. "Why we would take that away from ourselves is unfathomable to me. And why we would become a military-first foreign policy is unfathomable to me." There's a real corrosion of the sense of American leadership in the world and the institutions that make that leadership real, added Bill Burns. You end up creating a circumstance where you wake up 15 years from now and say, where are all those foreign service officers who should be just short of the mark of becoming ambassadors? And they're not going to be there. He remembered vividly the inversion of diplomacy and military might he had witnessed during the run-up to the war in Iraq. As he watched the precious few diplomatic accomplishments of the modern era fall like dominoes under the Trump administration, he couldn't help but see the parallel. Diplomacy really ought to be the tool of first resort internationally. It can sometimes achieve things at far less cost, both financially and in terms of American lives, than the use of the military can, Burns remarked. Some of the tilt toward military policymaking would be hard to undo, he conceded, but he was convinced there was always a path back. He still believed in the quality of Americans drawn to serve in his unglamorous but necessary line of work. I was reminded of something Richard Holbrooke had written as the State Department weathered the brutal budget cuts of the Clinton era in the introduction of To End a War, His Grand History of Bosnia, and, of course, himself. Today, public service has lost much of the aura that it had when John F. Kennedy asked us what we could do for our country. To hear that phrase before it became a cliché was electrifying. Public service can make a difference. If this book helps inspire a few young Americans to enter the government or other forms of public service, it will have achieved one of its goals. Holbrooke was an impossible blowhard, but his belief in America and its power to make peace, not just war, was achingly earnest. After he died, I remember sitting at my cubicle under the gray lights of the State Department's first floor, staring at that passage, and thinking that, for all his faults, he had achieved that goal for the group of staffers he nurtured in Afghanistan. Years later, I pulled the volume off a shelf and opened it to the same dog-eared page, and realized that I had written in pencil along the margin, "Miss you, Ambassador." As long as people continued to believe in civilian public service, Burns felt, the institutions would survive. The Foreign Service has often gotten the shit beaten out of it, he observed, sounding, for the first time, undiplomatic. It had always survived before. This time, he and virtually all of his peers agreed, it had to. In a world where power is more diffuse, in which there's so much that's in flux, that actually makes diplomacy far more important and far more relevant than it ever was before, contrary to the fashionable notion that, with information technology, who needs embassies? Tom Countryman was among those out of fashion. After his speech, he packed his bags and took a vacation. So it was that I caught up with him, sucking down e-cigarettes and looking out at the wide blue Puget Sound from his brother's modest one-story house in Tacoma, Washington. Several months later, I asked Brian Hook, the first policy planning director at State during the Trump era, what he would identify as that administration's signature diplomatic mission. Hook thought for a moment, as if turning over the question for the first time. In later conversations, he mentioned a broader range of priorities, including confronting ISIL. But in that first exchange, he said, finally, nonproliferation around dangerous states like Iran and North Korea. At the time, there was no one in charge of those issues at the State Department. For the following year, the job Tom Countryman once held would sit empty, like so many others. Acknowledgements. I conducted over 200 interviews for War on Peace. I owe much to the sources whose eyewitness accounts, documents, and insights run through every page. Some of your names I may never be able to make public. For every one of you who spoke, sometimes at personal or professional risk, thank you. To the career diplomats especially, Tom Countryman, Aaron Clancy, Robin Rafel, Ann Patterson, Bill Burns, Christopher Hill, Chris Levine, and too many others to list here. I hope this book is a fitting examination of the work you do. I hope it is the same for Richard Holbrooke and his complicated and important legacy. Without him, this book wouldn't exist. I'm equally grateful to the Secretaries of State who were gracious enough to go on the record. Henry Kissinger, George P. Shultz, James Baker, Madeleine Albright, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, and Rex Tillerson. They were generous with their time and their candor. The same thanks go to the other military and civilian leaders who spoke. David Petraeus, Michael Hayden, Leon Panetta, John Allen, James Stavridis, William Caldwell, and many others. Shana Monsbach, my indefatigable research assistant, was involved in hundreds of hours of interviews, proofing, and footnoting. She refused to drop the project, even when it ran longer than anticipated, and she had better damn things to do. She was preceded by the wonderful Ari Kuipers and Nathan Kohlenberg. All of us were given a safety net by Andy Young, my meticulous fact-checker, who made time to review manuscripts while being a full-time traveling companion to Lady Gaga for some reason. My agent, Lynn Nesbitt, fought hard to keep War on Peace alive. She is the best ally a writer could have. She's represented 50 years of literary luminaries, she's the toughest negotiator I know, and she manages regular kettlebell workouts. We should all be Lynn Nesbitt. I also owe thanks to the team at W.W. Norton, which published Dean Acheson's Present at the Creation in 1969, making this, in a sense, a very dark sequel. John Glusman was a patient and compassionate editor. Drake McFeely believed in the project when others were fickle and abandoned it and me. Many of their colleagues also worked hard. Louise Brockett, Rachel Salzman, Brendan Curry, Stephen Pace, Meredith McGinnis, Steve Attardo, Julia Druskin, Nancy Palmquist, and Helen Tamiades, among them. Books, like diplomacy, are an institution buffeted by changing times. Research-heavy ones take commitment from good and serious people like these. Several foreign policy experts I respect, including Ian Bremmer, Richard Haass, and Samantha Vinograd, looked at manuscripts and gave notes they didn't have time to give. They informed these pages greatly. David Remnick, David Rode, and my other editors at The New Yorker gave invaluable advice and politely tolerated the time I had to take off to finish the thing. Lastly, nothing I do would be possible without my family and the friends I have left after this book made me unpleasant and unavailable for half a decade. My mother was there for every excited call accompanying a breakthrough and every despairing one as things nearly fell apart. John Lovett, who usually charges for this sort of thing, gave countless notes. Jennifer Harris, I am sorry I missed your wedding to go interview a warlord. I really did rehearse that song.
This has been an Audible Studios production of War on Peace, The End of Diplomacy and the Decline of American Influence, written and performed by Ronan Farrow. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer Kat Lambrix. Directed by Bruce Katovich. Edited by Sarah Kosa. Mixed and mastered by Sarah Kosa. Copyright 2018 by Ronan Farrow. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.